We lose 2 million acres of grasslands every single year. We used to be able to hunt lesser prairie chickens 11 years ago. Now they've been listed twice under the Endangered Species Act. And this is on us hunters. We have concluded if we want to save prairie grouse, we must save ranching. And I will never forget, as he strutted, his eyeball rose above the branch and below the branch. As he took each step around the end of this branch and he stopped and looked at me, and I just drew back. And two populations of pronghorn found in North America that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. There's some genetically distinct population here.
Is there space to increase rangelands and cattle production while still maintaining our level of food output and agriculture?
I don't know in an ultimate sense, but I do know in a proximal sense. I mean,
Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, everyone, presented by Onyx Hunt. Today, we are excited to be joined once again by Ted Cook, retired endangered species biologist and current CEO of North American Grouse Partnership. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here and talk about all the things I'm passionate about.
Well, we know that, and from your previous appearances here on the show, and we certainly appreciate you joining us again today. We actually, before we hit record, we were talking about the Grandma's Sports Garden in Duluth being a lek of sorts. Do you care to elaborate on that? Your one visit to Duluth.
Yeah, so first thing I'm going to say is way back in 1995 when there was a volleyball bar, I guess, if that's the right place. But and being a super tall guy, I was so struck by the fact that I was average height walking around that bar. That was what I remember most about that. But what's funny about what you say, Nick, and about bars in general is just the parallel. Like, when I'm describing, like, to my, you know, my brother in Boston, you know, how do prairie grouse, you know, during breeding season, what do? Well, they attend leks. What does that mean? All these males show up and fight each other over women. Just picture a bunch of young 20-somethings going to the bar and strutting around the bar trying to pick up the hot chicks. You know, same thing.
Yep, not too different there. Yes, it is. I don't know specifically if we were chatting about this, but when you first said volleyball bar, I was like, "Do you mean hockey bar?" Because we're kind of a hockey town. But it's got to be that. I will have to ask my mom because like I said, she grew up here and she would know what.
It's the only play. I was so surprised. I'm like, "What's going on here?" And then I walked around and looked people in the eye at 6'4" tall and was even more surprised. So as you can tell, I remember it 30 years later. So.
Yeah. It's been a while since yours truly has been at Grandma's Sports Garden. I definitely did spend some time there in my college days, as many Duluth residents did. But back then, there were some pizza parties and hockey parties and stuff. So, yeah, maybe that was a place. But neither here nor there for today's conversation. It is just past mid-November, November 18th, when Ted and I are chatting. So what's keeping you busy right now? Are you distracted by, you know, the elk archery hunting? I know that's your passion. That's kind of over and done. I'd love to hear a little bit about your season this year, but what are you chasing, birds? You getting outside doing stuff, or are you busy with grouse partner work?
Yeah. So I've not chased birds yet this year, which shame on me for that. My backyard opportunity, I live an hour north of Boise, Idaho. And my backyard opportunity is ruffed grouse here, which I'm looking forward to putting some feathers in my dog's mouth, but I haven't been out for prairie grouse or at all. But yeah, so what's and my elk season was really interesting. It's public lands, elk hunting in central Idaho, beautiful places I get to go. It's actually a place that Ernest Hemingway used to hunt and fish in central Idaho, right in the middle of Idaho. It's a gorgeous valley, a gorgeous spot. I unfortunately had the poorest year of archery elk hunting, I think, of my, well, other than my first year or two when I stumbled through the woods, I'd spook a herd of elk and declare victory. Yeah, and I'd be like, I've spooked a herd of elk, I'm the man. Well, since then, that was 35 years ago, I've been able to kill a bunch of elk with my bow.
Oh, wow.
Muzzleloader, yeah. And rifles. But anyway, this may be my poorest elk season since the beginning. And except for the last day, my buddy and I, you know, made the commitment and went into our deepest secret, most secret honey hole. And we got in there and we saw 6 elk. And then we saw 6 more elk. And then we saw 15 more elk. We ended up, I never forget the number that day, but I don't know, upwards of 100 elk ended up making their way. What you have to do is you climb up the side of this mountain, and there's this deep hole in the backside that's inaccessible. And elk just kept piling in there all, you know, early to late morning. And so we finally set up for the afternoon hunt. We get in there. My buddy got real close to the biggest herd bull, but, you know, like 80 yards, but couldn't close the deal. Well, I ended up trying to get close to elk on a different finger ridge in this honey hole. And there were so many elk that between 4:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. on that day, more than 50% of the time, the air was filled with notes of a bull bugling. And I've never experienced that in my life. There had to be 8 to 12 bulls on this one ridge across from me. And I swear they took turns bugling because sometimes they overlapped each other, but far more often it'd be like, wow, 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 on different parts of the ridge. I'm like, it was like, and there were, you know, many, many dozens of cows. I don't know. Let's say there were 60, 80 elk all over this finger ridge. The problem is when you're bow hunting, that's, you know, let's say there was 80 elk where there's 160 eyeballs.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I'm on the
and
Jason
nostrils.
Ridge trying to get, trying to get into the creek bottom to get on their ridge, to get behind cover, to get close enough to, man, I would see a cow looking at me and I'd freeze and she'd go back to grazing and I'd take 2 steps and another cow would be standing there staring at me, you know, like 150 yards. Anyway, so I didn't get a shot, but it was so sensory. It was, and actually, as I was stalking in, there were elk on my ridge. I got to within 40 yards of a group of cows that I never saw because it was too thick. And we talked back, and like, what happened? I'm walking along, I step on a rock, it rolls down the hill, right? And I'm like, oh gosh. All of a sudden, you know, 40 yards ahead of me. I tried talking back, but they didn't buy it. They left. So anyway, really fun, exciting, but really didn't get very close, but just a wonderful time in the Rocky Mountains in September.
Yeah, man, I've never experienced it. It's something I hear about from my Western guests and connections and that sort of thing. And I could imagine that's kind of like a, you know, in a way, elk hunter's dream to listen to all that bugling. I've got a little, my buddy Levi, who's from Idaho, actually, he has drawn the comparison that he's not a huge turkey hunter, but he's kind of like turkey hunting's kind of like, you know, sort of the spring elk hunt with the gobbling. And, you know, I've got a taste for that over the past few years, and it definitely has captured my attention. So I could only imagine what that must sound like again, in the setting, the mountains and everything. Yeah.
But your buddy Levi is exactly right. This spring I ended up shooting my gobbler at 12 yards. And, you know, I was closing in. I got as close as I could. I stuck a little decoy out, called. He called. I called a little closer. All of a sudden he called at like under 20 yards. And the thunder that hits your chest.
Yeah.
And you need to jump, you know, and then it all holds still. And then he popped up. Anyway, you know, that's like elk hunting. Totally is. It's so exciting.
Yeah. I should not, I mean, it's mid-November. I should not be thinking about turkey hunting, but it's, I don't know. It's one of those things that it has absolutely captured my attention. Now, was that with I know you're a traditional archery guy. Was that with a bow also?
Okay, the turkey? No, a shotgun. I love turkey hunting, but killing one with their eyeballs are amazing. Killing one of the bows is really hard. And I'm not that passionate. I keep telling myself one of these years I want to make the effort to poke one with a sharp stick, but you know, it's kind of like what I ended up, what I often do, they're all around my home here in Idaho. And so I end up thinking, oh, I'm not going to get up and hunt for 3 hours tomorrow morning. And that's not really, you know, if you're going to kill one with a bow, it's a commitment. So I don't make that level of commitment with turkeys.
Yeah. Yeah. Hard to get to full draw with those eyeballs on you, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So are you done elk hunting? Do you rifle hunt, gun hunt at all?
You know, so my tag that I get allows me a early November 10-day antlerless muzzleloader season. So if I don't score with my bow in September, I can go out in early November. And I actually did that for a day and a half. And oh my gosh, I got into it. The elk that we counted that day on the ridge across from us after they had successfully avoided us that morning, it was 180 elk. All within RV. We're in the small remote canyon, actually in the corner of a congressionally designated wilderness area. And half a dozen elk were coming underneath. I moved around to get in front of them, and I'm pretty sure I spooked them, although it was such a slow-mo spook, but they turned and went down drainage, which usually is a sign that they didn't like something in your neighborhood. So, but anyway, so I didn't get a shot there, but we spent the whole day, it was after a fresh snowfall and mountains of Idaho, and just incredible, near the Lost River Range, which is includes the tallest peak in Idaho, Bora Peak, and this was striking, and you know, draped in snow with the sagebrush flats below, and you know, pockets of big pockets of aspen and Doug fir and open sage slopes, and 180 elk all in this bare ridge top above the timber. Just so romantic and beautiful and lovely and fun, and but again, didn't get to kill anything.
Yeah, 35 years, you haven't lost the passion. That's clear.
Yeah, man, you are right, Nick. I mean, and I'm 60. I'll be 62 years old next week, and I just think, how many more years am I going to have? I mean, in some ways, I'm really starting to feel that pressure, because elk hunting, especially on public lands, is not
tough.
Yeah, easy. So, in some ways, maybe my passion is becoming more rabid, because I don't know how many more years I'll have.
Yeah, right. Now, the listeners will know, I don't really have a lot of experience big game hunting, other than deer camp and that sort of thing. And that's been on my, I mean, it's hard not to think about that. Here is sort of the peak of gun seasons in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so there's a lot of that going on. I don't think I'm going to hunt this year. I'm going to get my deer camp established. I've got two young boys, and they're getting to be that age. They're really interested.
Excellent.
So I want them to have deer camp experience that I didn't have when I was really young, but eventually I found it, and I love that stuff. So, but anyways, having not hunted like a herd animal like that, is that a typical hunt where are you trying to locate a group of elk and just sort of get in and around
yes.
them? So obviously, you know, traditional archery hunting, you got to be closer than anything, but what does like an ideal elk hunt look like?
Yeah, that's exactly. Well, the ideal elk, the number one way I measure the quality of my hunts is by the number of other hunters I do not see. If I'm alone, that's everything. And then spotting elk before they spot you is like the first step to success. If you don't do that, you're probably not going to score with a bow. And then once you spot them, that's when the chess game begins, and just trying to get in front of them, get close, control the wind. The older I get, the less I use calls. I had this amazing story once about how my wife, who's not a hunter at all, and for years she packed the cooler for me, and she helped me butcher, you know, elk when I brought them home. Finally, the kids were old enough. She came with me one year, and I taught her how to blow a cow call, and she called a bull into me. And it was the most, is she not a hunter, but she supports it. She feels my passion. She sees it. She called that bull in. I shot it at 5 yards with my recurve. I turn around and she's jumping up and down, pumping her fists in the air, that we just worked together to close the deal. Anyway, so that's kind of the scenario. That's the only one of the few times I've really used a call very successfully. And it was my wife doing it. It was just incredible. But otherwise, I hunt real quietly and just try to get in front and ambush.
That primal instinct, the success of the hunt, you know, I think that's encoded in
she
everyone.
Was lit up like a light bulb. I had my daughter, who killed her first and only elk with a rifle, had a similar experience. I'll just real, you know, she killed it. There's she tears, you know, and then elation, and then cutting it up and packing it out. And she's like, Dad, next year I want to hunt again. You know, Dad, next year I want to hunt with a bow. Dad, next year I want to hunt with a traditional bow. You know, as we're walking down the trail, like it's all within like 5 minutes. Dad, I don't want to hunt just with a traditional bow. I want to make my own bow in the elk next year. I'm like, honey, slow down. So that
common
fire,
trajectory, but usually it takes a little longer than that.
Yeah. In about a 5 minute span of packing a heavy elk quarter on her back down this mountain trail, she went from one to hunt, you know, with a gun next year to make her own bow.
That's awesome. Oh yeah, I did hear you mention that on a different podcast that you had shot two bulls at 4 and 5 yards, and I mean that had to be thrilling, obviously, to be that close to an animal of that size. I can't even imagine. I mean, it's got to be an intense moment.
Intimidating. So the one the biggest bull I've killed, it was like a 300 point bull or something. I had it measured, and I had spotted this for, you know, I it's the same honey hole that we had all the bugling this year. And this is back in 2004. So 21 years ago, I was on the same ridge looking. It was the morning and it was late in the season. It had snowed 2 inches. It was like September 25th and no elk. And I saw a coyote and I thought, well, I'll try to call this coyote and shoot a coyote with my bow, which I've never done. And I was about to start screaming, you know, on a predator call, and I heard a bugle, and then this herd comes over the ridge and goes down to the bottom. So I followed in there, and they hang up in some timber, and so I hang up and I eat my lunch and I take a nap, and I wake up and it's snowing and I'm freezing cold trying to get warm. The bull starts bugling. I see a second herd come up from the bottom, kind of like this year, you know, all of a sudden elk are starting to show up in different places in this honey hole. And I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going over there. So I go over there, I start going up in the timber, and I hear this sawing noise, and I'm convinced that somebody's making a camp right where I just heard the bull bugling, you know, 45 minutes earlier, and I'm apoplectic. Yeah. I'm like, how could this happen? And then all of a sudden the sawing noise gets closer, and I look at, and I've got an arrow knocked, and I'm behind this big dug fir tree trunk just looking up the hill into this thick timber wondering what's up. And the sawing noise gets closer. I'm like, well, that's weird. Do you think they'd saw in one place? And I look up, and as it gets closer, and suddenly over the roll on the hill are all these white antler tips rocking back and forth, this big 6-point bull. And he is breathing like he's sawing wood.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my God. And he's like 35 yards away. Well, he gets right above me and turns and starts walking straight down at me with all these dagger points in his shoulders out and his chin up and is strutting and is, and I'm like, oh no, I'm gonna die. I'm the one with the bow and arrow, right? But I'm like, crap.
Yeah,
he comes down 20 yards, 15 yards, 10 yards, 7 yards. He's still coming straight at me,
straight at
and you. Fortunately, off this huge dug fir tree where there's a 6-inch thick branch that came off horizontally, and he gets to that branch and he turns and he walks, and I will never forget how his eyeball, as he strutted, his eyeball rose above the branch and below the branch and above the branch as he took each step around the end of this branch. And he stopped and at 5 yards and looked at me, and I just drew back and whack, you know.
Holy cow.
But how I overcame the absolute fear from 3 seconds earlier to have the presence to actually shoot him, I don't know. But let me tell you, it doesn't get life. You can't think about anything else in the world in that moment. And that's one of the beauties of elk hunting. It's like when the bird gets up and you know before the gun hits your shoulder that you're going to kill it, because you're on the barrel, you know.
I mean, it doesn't get old, even, you know, hearing about somebody else's moment. I mean, that's part of it, the thrill of the hunt. But it's, anybody listening to this show is going to understand that, but it's that moment where everything comes together, you know. It's the intensity, and that's why you put yourself in those places. That's what we pursue. I mean, that's so cool. The visual memory that you've got burned in of, you know, the branch, I can imagine how that might be, but only you experienced it. That's incredible.
Yeah, but you're right. The power of storytelling Yeah. You know, in the most ancient form of storytelling is telling stories about the hunt. You know, what did ancient humans draw on cave walls? Stories of the hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's phenomenal. Well, I appreciate you sharing some of that with us. Like I said, it's that time of year, and boy, elk hunting sounds kind of fun.
Yeah. So that other story I won't tell that I had this year was I was on a ridge at 10,000 feet this season and watched a golden eagle try to kill a juvenile red-tailed hawk.
Whoa.
That was and it happened below me. I was at 10,000 feet and it happened below. Wow. I watched it from the top. It was so incredible.
Spectacle.
All right, let's talk about
Grouse Partners.
About.
Yeah. Yeah, what's going on in the world of North American Grouse Partnership?
So, great question. Thank you for asking. So, we are our mission is to save grouse and their habitats. We are focused on prairie grouse, which is like sharp-tailed grouse, greater prairie chickens, lesser prairie chickens, and sage grouse. And the reason we're focused on prairie grouse is because grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and in the world. Okay? And think about this. Think of all your listeners out there who like to hunt different things, elk or prairie grouse or ducks or whatever. Yeah. Think of if there's any other group of huntable animals that we could say anything like this about. Here's our most recent insight into the degree to which grasslands and prairie grouse are threatened, okay? Of the 9 prairie grouse populations historically found across North America, 9 prairie grouse populations historically found across North America, 6 are either extinct or recognized under the Endangered Species Act, and the other 3 are declining. So prairie grouse populations, so like there's 2 official populations of lesser prairie chickens. There's 3 official populations of sage grouse that are kind of broken out in different ways. There's heath hens that are extinct and Atwater's prairie chicken in coastal Texas that are functionally extinct in the wild. And there are subspecies of the greater prairie chicken. And so the 3 that are declined are the sharp-tailed grouse, greater prairie chicken, and greater sage grouse. Yeah. So bi-state sage grouse and Gunnison sage grouse in Colorado are both recognized under the Endangered Species Act in different ways. Candidates are listed or whatever. So of the 9 populations of prairie grouse historically found in North America, 6 are either extinct or recognized under the Endangered Species Act. The other 3 are declining. I mean, do you know, Nick, of any other group of game animals that experience that level of threat?
I don't think I could name one. I mean, you know, again, in the big game world, it's, you know, maybe we have so much variety in the bird world populations and stuff, but no, I don't know.
Yeah. So, and then match it up in the big game world. Interesting you say that, Nick, because there are 2 big game species in my mind, and I might be biased because I always think about grasslands, but there are 2 big game species in my mind that are suffering declines in at least parts of their range, one of them across their range. More so than any other big game species, and rather than try to quiz you on this, I'll just say the big one to me is mule deer.
Mule deer.
You know, Idaho used to be an incredible mule deer state. Now there's still mule deer here, right? You can still hunt them, but man, fewer than ever. Kansas, where we're currently doing a lot of work to save lesser prairie chickens, working with private landowners, mule deer are just in the toilet. And then for pronghorns, same thing. They're declining in many places, and in fact, I don't know if your listeners know, there are 2 populations of pronghorn found in North America that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. Pronghorn listed under the Endangered Species Act. Not in the main part of their range, but in California and in Arizona, both have populations that are already protected. Now, here's the thing for your listeners to contemplate when it comes to huntable populations of critters. I already gave the stats on prairie grouse. That should concern us all. But think about this. All it takes is a scientist to do a genetic analysis of, say, pronghorn or mule deer in the southwestern Great Plains and say, you know what, there's some genetically distinct population here. And the next thing you know, another group is going to petition to list those under the Endangered Species Act. Imagine mule deer or pronghorn in the southern part of the range being proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act. It's not that outlandish. It's not that far away. That's how threatened grasslands are in North America. So that's our space.
Mule deer, pronghorn being tied to the loss of grasslands, I'm assuming?
Yes. Sorry if I didn't make that clear. Clearly pronghorn, you know, are a prairie species, but mule deer really like those open spaces as well. And they can be, they're found in the mountains of Idaho as well, but even there, they're declining. But in Kansas, it's a real problem. And it's the same thing, habitat loss and fragmentation. That's why that lesser prairie chickens have been listed twice under the Endangered Species Act. That's why grassland birds have declined more than any other group of birds in North America. You know, waterfowl, songbirds, you name it, forest birds, nothing has declined more than grassland birds. So savannah sparrows and meadowlarks, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, what is the makeup of said grasslands with respect to public lands, private lands? You know, where are they and how are they disappearing?
I read a stat from the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies recently. 84% of remaining grasslands are privately owned working rangelands. It's the flyover country, right? It's the flat stuff. Yeah. It's the stuff we don't think about or ostensibly care about, although some of us care a lot, like a lot of your listeners, I'll bet. and so here's the thing. Grasslands, most threatened ecosystem on the continent of the world. 84% of remaining grasslands are privately owned working rangelands, you know, ranching. Ranching pays less than any other form of land use. And that is why grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and the world. Very simple construct. This is not complicated. If a rancher can make more money letting trees grow and renting it out for hunting white-tailed deer, which he often can, that's what he's going to do. If a rancher can lease his land for a power line or a wind project or a solar project or gas wells, that's what they will do. And if a rancher, the subsidies for farming, I have a friend in South Dakota that says, even at record high beef prices right now, he could double his income tomorrow by breaking out his rangeland and farming it. It's purely from the subsidies alone. Even if he never grew and sold a bushel of corn, he can make more money breaking it out farming and earning the subsidies. We wonder why grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem. It's clear. It's economics.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard you say that. And it doesn't take a huge leap to, you know, ranching takes a lot of work too. You're right. It's a lifestyle. I mean, it's
labor of love.
Labor of love. And I think that's understood, but stack that up against, you know, your ROI is less than all of these other things. I mean, the incentive structure is not correct for preserving grasslands.
Yeah. And so here's, you know, couple other stats. So the number of livestock producers in the U.S. is down 40% since late last century. The U.S. cattle herd is at its lowest point since 1951. 41 out of the 44 counties in the historic range of lesser prairie chickens have lost population since late last century. Why? Because ranching doesn't pay. Now, here's a really appalling stat. Guess how much, and this is a quiz for you, guess how much U.S. grass-fed labeled beef is from the U.S., is actually from the U.S. Guess how much U.S. grass-fed labeled beef is actually from the U.S. Just wild guess.
20%?
Ooh, 17%.
I didn't know that, but I just, the way you framed it up, I was betting that it was going to be a surprisingly low number. So
imagine
guess.
That. You go buy U.S. grass-fed labeled beef at the grocery store, there's an 80% chance, 83% chance, that is not from the U.S.
It's coming from, like, New Zealand and stuff, right?
Argentina Brazil and all that. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So we wonder why. And so the whole thesis of the North American Grouse Partnership, we're focused on grasslands, most threatened ecosystem, prairie grouse are in the toilet, all nine historic populations. 84% of grasslands are privately owned working rangelands. We have concluded, the North American Grouse Partnership has concluded, if we want to save prairie grouse, we must save ranching.
Yeah.
Is it because the North American Grouse Partnership loves ranchers? No. Although I happen to know a lot of ranchers personally that I truly love and are incredible. And you said it, Nick, you implied this earlier. The reason why these people are still doing it is because they love the lifestyle and they love the land. They don't want to break it out into farm ground and double their income tomorrow because they love the lifestyle and they love the land. That is not a recipe for conservation success. If we don't start paying them for the ecosystem services they're giving to all of us, the walk-in hunting for sharp-tailed grouse, whatever it is, if we don't start actually paying for that stuff, it will continue to go away. We lose 2 million acres of grasslands every single year.
Two million acres.
Yeah, on our watch. Our game, we used to be able to hunt lesser prairie chickens 11 years ago. Now they've been listed twice under the Endangered Species Act. And this is on us hunters. And this is one of our failures in our system, our North American model of conservation. Once we begin to lose access to a species for hunting purposes, it falls off hunters' radar screens. Mm-hmm. Is it because hunters are bad people and they don't care? No, of course not. It's just the way that our system is constructed, where you pay license dollars and Pittman Robertson dollars, you know, on hunting and hunting gear and ammo and that sort of thing. Once you can no longer hunt the species, you can't spend those dollars conserving those species. Are there any other dollars to take their place? No. Then suddenly they slip towards being listed under the Endangered Species Act, pronghorn, right? I mean, this is really, this is a call to your listeners. I mean, work with us to figure out ways to change that paradigm. We have got to find ways to, one, not lose access to being able to hunt these species, right? Keep them huntable. That's job one. Yeah. In Idaho, I used to be able to, you know, just buy my hunting license at a part of it. I could go shoot 2 sage grouse a day. Now I have to apply for a tag to shoot 2 sage grouse in a year.
Yeah.
That's not okay. And that's happening on my watch as a hunter, and that's not okay. Man, you got me fired up again.
Yeah, clearly that's all right. The private land, just to put that, public lands are obviously, you know, something that we all value. And, you know, I do, I would say 99.9% of my hunting on public land here in the forested regions of the world. You know, it's a little bit different. I do go out west on a sharptail hunt where I do hunt private land open to the public, right? Those private land access programs. But it's just thinking about how much of the available habitat is on private lands, which is good and bad, because it's, you know, it's harder to manage those at scale, but it is good conceivably if the land is managed properly, that's good for wildlife and birds and habitat. And then if you can keep the connectivity between those private lands and the public lands, that's how good habitat works. Because habitat fragmentation is this other thing, especially with birds, right? They just, if they don't have the big contiguous spaces, certain species more than others, they just start to fall off.
Amen, brother. Amen. And prairie grouse are the poster child for that. If you can stand in one spot in grasslands and see nothing but the low ridge 2 miles away from you and nothing taller than that in between, that's what prairie grouse need. But if you see, a gully full of tall cottonwood trees or a power line going through, or God forbid, a wind farm, you know, a towering wind farm, then the prairie grouse, it only takes as little as 4% of the landscape to be occupied by structures taller than, say, 12 feet for prairie grouse to begin to leave that part of the landscape. That's how sensitive they are to that. And that's why they're such a great indicator species. And that's why, recently, so I don't know if your listeners have heard of the North American Pronghorn Foundation. A group just formed a year ago to save pronghorn. And we recently connected and partnered it up to work together on these things, because, you know, what's good for the pronghorn is good for the prairie chicken and vice versa. So, so habitat is everything.
You know, the tall structure thing, that one, I've heard that often enough. It's the, you know, predators, right? Like avian predators, they're on there. So the prairie grouse avoid that. Are there any other, like, nuanced, for the pronghorn, is it just simply habitat loss and fragmentation, or are there any weird things like that?
The fragment, you said it so well, Nick, the fragmentation is like the big thing for prairie grouse and for for pronghorn. Pronghorn are, you know, notoriously challenged for crossing fence lines and highways, you know, and so the more fence lines, the more highways, the harder it is, you know. It's not a tough equation. You mentioned that it's, you know, easier to manage larger tracts of public land. It's easier to manage large tracts of land. I mean, we've got least one rancher with 30,000 acres who's all in on managing for lesser prairie chickens, and who, by the way, has one of the most successful cattle businesses in the state of Kansas. It's easier to manage private land in that case because you only have one person making the decisions.
Correct.
And thank goodness they're making the right decisions. But you know why they're making the right decisions? They're getting paid a lot of money per acre to do it. And I shouldn't say a lot because it's not a lot. It's so current, the Farm Bill Conservation Title Program that since 1985, for 40 years, we've been operating under the assumptions that the best approach is to offer subsidies, cost shares, and incentives, as if these landowners don't know what they're doing. They need to be offered guidance. They need to be given a cookie. You know, here, please walk down this trail a little bit farther, a little bit farther. And after 40 years, we can see that we're losing 2 million acres of grasslands every year. It doesn't work. Number of livestock producers is down. The U.S. cattle herd is at its lowest point. We are not being successful using it. Now, those programs are great on an acre-by-acre basis. They help wherever they're applied. It's just when you step back and look at it from the big picture, we're failing hugely. Grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem, okay? And so rather than offering subsidies, cost shares, and incentives, the analogy I like to use is every year the federal government buys, say, 100 pickup trucks from Ford Motor Company. One, they don't tell Ford how to build them. And two, they don't turn around and ask Ford, hey, Ford, what's your cost share? Right? They pay fair market value for that truck, and they treat Ford like the business professionals that they are. It's time to start treating private lands ranchers that way. And the way we do it is pretty simple, okay? These ranchers, the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance is the group of rancher conservationist heroes with whom we're working right now in Lesser Prairie Chicken Country. These ranchers want negotiated contracts to produce conservation outcomes. What does that mean? Very simple. It's a three-step process. One, you agree on the conservation outcome. We want healthy grasslands, you know, with tall grass tall enough to hide a lesser prairie chicken. We want to agree on a dollar amount per acre and a number of years that you're willing to do it. And then the third step is we'll monitor at every year and pay you when you succeed. So outcomes-based grazing. That's it. It's very simple, right? What do you think of that? Does that make sense? Did I say that?
It makes sense to me. It's putting a value on things that return value to wildlife and habitat. And tell me more about what those conservation service. It's healthy, you know. It's grasslands, carbon storage through grasslands, healthy water, right? It's that
yeah.
sort of stuff.
So here's I'll list them in a second, but I'll preface it with this little factoid. Healthy rangelands retain up to 66% more water than bare ground.
Mm.
So even if you only cared about water quality and water quantity,
yeah.
you would want healthy rangelands. And look at the places where the Ogallala Aquifer is declining, you know, across the Western Great Plains, right? Especially Kansas, Colorado area. So the values are clean air, right? Remember the Dust Bowl?
Yeah.
That's happening on a smaller scale as we speak in that same region, that same New Mexico, Texas, you know, Oklahoma region. We're seeing too much bare soil. Okay. Clean air, clean water, more water, healthy soils, which is the key that all ranchers, all agriculturalists focus on, healthy soils, healthy vegetation, healthy wildlife, and carbon storage. Okay. Those seven things. So that's what the American public gets when they pay fair market value for the conservation services that ranchers have to offer. And at the same time, the ranchers, like I say, this one super successful rancher with 30,000 acres in Western Kansas, he's still super successful as a rancher. And he's grazing
I'm glad you brought him back up. What makes his property work, do you think?
The chickens are here because of us, not in spite of us. And he knows it, and he believes it, and he loves it. He's passionate about his lifestyle, and he's passionate about the quality of his land. And somebody came along and said, can we pay you to keep these chickens here? He's like, hell yeah. I'm already doing it. Go ahead, and it just increases my income. And it means that, and there's a permanent conservation easement on those lands too, by the way, Nick, which is like fundamentally important, right? And so that is the future. If we want to save grasslands, if we want to save prairie grouse, if we want to save pronghorn and mule deer, these are the deals we need to be cutting. We've got 100,000 acres under our belt so far in Lesser Prairie Chicken Range. So that's Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado. And our goal is to get 2 million acres.
100,000 acres you've got?
Yeah. And then to grow that out to the Northern Great Plains and to sagebrush ecosystems and everywhere else.
When you say permanent conservation easement, what exactly does that mean? Just that those will always be healthy range or range lands?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's an agreement that those lands will be managed as range land. They can graze them, but right. they have to graze into a specific. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stuck their neck out and said, here's the vegetative outcomes that need to be provided on somebody's ranch in order to grow lesser prairie chickens. And so this private business person actually came in and said, okay, I'm going to set up he got an Endangered Species Act permit that said if a rancher does this, then they're good. And so, and then he can sell those credits to a wind energy developer. So he actually set up a private business around this, which recently was undermined when lesser prairie chickens were removed from the protections of the Endangered Species Act due to a procedural concern. But anyway, so there's this document that says the vegetative outcome. So this businessman goes to this rancher and says, hey, do you want to agree to produce these vegetative outcomes? And the rancher is like, yeah, that's what I do because it's healthy.
I'm doing that already, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Or close enough to doing it that they're like, yeah, I want to do it. If I get paid, I'll definitely do that because I might have to cut my herd by 20%, but I'm going to be getting paid significantly more
to offset that.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of just growing cows and getting paid for growing cows, he's growing cows and he's growing chickens and he's getting paid to grow both.
Yeah.
So there's the vegetative outcomes and then there's the conservation easement that says you'll leave it as chicken habitat forever. And then there's an endowment funded to manage those lands forever. So not only is there an easement, but there's a bank account set up and you use the interest to, you know, burn certain amount of rangeland every year, that sort of thing. And then they go in and they do restoration up front. So if there's areas already taken over by woodlands, they remove those woodlands and make it chicken habitat. And then at the end of all that, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, under their authorities of the Endangered Species Act, says, yep, that checks all the boxes. You're a good rancher and you're a good businessman. Then the businessman turns around and sells those credits to a wind energy developer somewhere else who's impacting marginal chicken habitat. And so it's been a really good tool for saving chickens.
Apologies if I missed this, but where did the money come from to pay that rancher for the Lesser Prairie Chicken Alliance?
So in this is called conservation banking, okay? And so under this scenario, this private businessman fronted all the money. So he fronted, I don't know, several million dollars. It cost him $4 million in 4 years just to get the Endangered Species Act permit. And then he's got to pay people to, you know, measure habitat and, you know, lawyers to do all the contracting, and he's got to pay his taxes and all that stuff. Well, he believes so much in this private model of conservation funding that he got private investors to back him out of Chicago who embraced his vision. And he spent years and years getting the permit, getting approvals, setting this up, negotiating deals. It took him 2 years to negotiate this deal with this one particular landowner who's like, who are you? What are you doing? I've never heard of this, right? I mean, imagine the skepticism, right? And then he finally secures the deal, and then he finally gets it approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then he can finally market those conservation banking credits to a wind energy developer.
Okay.
So he bet on the come.
He's not the wind farmer. He's the broker, essentially, between the wind farmer and the rancher.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And so because he made all these upfront investments and got the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to sign off on everything, then he has a very powerful tool to offer the landowner, which is payment for these services and a permanent get-out-of-jail-free card from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then that value, then, you know, for when the species was listed under the SA, so his business model just went away when the judge delisted chickens, right? But when it was listed, the wind energy developers that were going to impact marginal chicken habitat elsewhere had this obligation to mitigate. Now, the wind energy developer could choose to do their own thing, but it's way easier for them to just write a check to somebody. And that's where
done the legwork and that's value add there.
Yeah. Okay. That's right.
What is the push-pull competition like? You're thinking like agriculture, we got to feed the world, you know, we need food. Is there space to increase rangelands and cattle production while still maintaining our level of food output and agriculture, that kind of thing? I mean, what's the dynamics there?
Yeah, great question. Where's the ultimate limit? And I don't know in an ultimate sense, but I do know in a proximal sense. I mean, there's such heavy economic incentives to break out lands to turn into farm ground, that the phrase that's used in the business, especially amongst my rancher friends, is marginal farm ground. And so here's a story. One of our Texas Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance members tells me about how organic peanut farming subsidies are destroying remaining grasslands all around him. And he's holding out because he loves ranching and he loves grasslands and he wants lesser prairie chickens. I don't think he has any on his property currently, but he wants them back. Okay. But all around him, his neighbors are breaking out their grasslands to turn into organic peanut farming. And they're drilling wells every, whatever, quarter mile right along the boundary of his property because the regulations for groundwater use in Texas are inadequate, apparently. And then they're, you know, marginally irrigated. They're buying new pickup trucks or buying new center pivot irrigation systems. And this rancher buddy of mine says, most of them will never even sell a single organic peanut. But just based on the subsidies alone, they'll get rich. Now, that's just one version of the story. I'm sure an organic peanut farmer would rip me a new one if they heard me say it that way. But the point is this. But we have these perverse incentives to break out marginal ground to grow crops that probably aren't ever going to grow that well in that particular environment. Okay? And so where's the space ultimately to maintain our farm production and increase our grasslands and range production? It's in that space right there, right? By the way, another Les Preaching on Organized member friend told me there's a term for that organic peanut farming thing. It's called farming the program. You're not actually, so there's an actual term for it, farming the program. You're not actually farming anticipating ever pulling out a profitable crop. You're farming knowing that if you plant it, even if it doesn't grow, you'll get the payment from the federal government and you'll make a profit. Farming the program.
Well, number one, I better stop buying organic peanut butter from Costco. That's number one. My wife already tells me I eat too much peanut butter, but it's a hard habit to kick. but then there's, again, the concept there, efficiency and inefficiency, right? It's inefficiency of government program, maybe a little too loose restrictions, requirements to get said subsidies. So you've got people doing it on ground that, you know, doesn't make sense. That would we would likely be better served if that were rangelands and wildlife habitat. Yeah. So we need to sort of clean that up. And obviously that's way easier said than done, but that's how to think about it. What's
that's occurring. Right. And I don't hate farming. But what's clear to me, and I'm as an endangered 30-year endangered species, I don't know nothing about farm. I don't know. The ranchers have taught me everything I know, right? Over the last three and a half years, it's been a wonderful partnership. But all I can say is it's clear to me that the farm, interestingly, you know, have you heard of the farm bill, right? The farm
bill? Yes.
Yeah. It's not the farm and ranch bill. It's the farm bill. Why? Because farming dominates. Why does farming dominate? Because I think a lot of companies, maybe John Deere, Monsanto, I don't know, make a lot of money. You know, the more farm ground, more ground that gets broken out for farming, the more equipment and chemicals they sell, right? And so, and again, they're not bad people. It's just that's the business model. They've captured, you know, our nation's decision makers, and they've pushed this in a direction to the point of, in my opinion, absurdity. If there's a term in the industry, farming the program, that indicates you've gone too far.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Does that answer your question, Nick? Is that a,
it does. It does. Honestly, you're helping. It makes sense. Like when you say it that way, but you're helping sort of shape my understanding. I mean, it's easy to see. You have to take a step back. And it's like you said, it's not that farming is the enemy, but you look at the business and the incentives around it, you know, the equipment and the chemicals and even just the seed, just everything. Whereas you think about ranchers, you know, you got some cows and some grass, some native grass. Like there's not this whole industry propelling it. It's back to that way of life. And so probably going to take some serious rethinking of incentives and structure to tip the scales perhaps back in favor of that.
You said it perfectly. And here's the appalling thing. And this is my words only. No rancher has said this to me, but sometimes I wonder if the North American Grouse Partnership is a rancher's best friend. I mean, all of the industry groups, the industry itself, you know, the beef importers, the beef processors, you know, the slaughterhouses, if all the beef is imported, fine with them. They need beef in their slaughterhouse, you know, and that's a problem right now, right? So even like this whole thing with Trump saying they're going to import more Argentine beef, it really hit a sore spot with ranchers and they really erupted, and I don't blame them. But at the end of the day, my rancher friends are like, you know, we really are short on beef. If we imported more in the short term, that's probably not a bad thing. But we really got to start investing in American ranching. Yeah. And yeah. And so, but nobody's looking out for these ranchers. When I started with Alaska Project Landowner Lands 3.5 years ago, they said, Ted, you know, all these conservation groups and all these industry groups go to DC every year and they tell the politicians what we ranchers need. But nobody ever asks us. You're the first person, Ted, to ask us, what do we really need? And what do they need? They need negotiated contracts for conservation outcomes so they can develop a second income stream along with selling beef so they can stay on the land and not have to sell out to farming or to wind energy or solar or oil and gas or power lines or roads or blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's a lot. It's a lot to think about. And again, I'm Northern Minnesota and Northwoods guy, but I find it interesting. I sort of think about my appreciation for, I've grown and developed an appreciation for working forests, right? It's active forest management that creates disturbance, that perpetuates rough grouse and the stuff that I grew up, you know, hunting and appreciating. And to this day I do. And it's the same story. Now I go out west and I hunt sharptails and I see this working landscape. It's cattle and it's grazing and it's beautiful habitat. And so it's the same thing. So the appreciation was easy to develop in my short, you know, trips out there every year, but it's just, now it's obviously in peril and something that my awareness has arisen because I value the hunt, right? It's how so many people find it. It's like you talk about when a species, you lose a hunting season, you lose opportunity, you lose value. It's just sort of human nature, but we have this still and it's worth fighting for, which again, everybody listening to this show gets that. I think it's maybe the reason I like to have these conversations is to help increase all of our knowledge and awareness, but then it's also what do we do about it? What can we do about it?
Yeah. And so yes. And so let me first say rough grouse, same exact story, habitat loss and fragmentation. And this, and my friend Ben Jones, you know, runs Rough Grouse Society. I think it's America's obsession with trees and you can't cut any trees. That's kind of the right. And I think it's Indiana recently listed rough grouse under their state endangered species act. Come on. What are we doing? And so working landscapes, you're right. And what a rough grouse need more than anything, I think, you know, by the way, everyone should become a member of the Rough Grouse Society and the North American Grouse Partnership, NAGP.org. North American Grouse Partnership, and Rough Grouse Society, because they're really fighting the same battle we are, just on behalf of rough grouse specifically, but the same equation. And so what can we do? This is what I tell you, Nick, it's funny. I think of myself as a pretty smart guy and I care a lot. But as I say, I'm ignorant of Farm Bill and, you know, a lot of this stuff. I mean, I've worked with ranchers a lot under the Endangered Species Act, but never on this financial side of the equation. But our whole deal, the North American Grouse Partnership, Saving Grassland, Saving Prairie Grouse, we have to save ranching. How do you save ranching? You pay them more. What opportunities do we hunters have to support paying ranchers more? The conservation title of the Farm Bill. And that's the subsidy cost share incentive thing for the last 40 years that's done wonders on the acres of grounds that has been implemented, but has been insufficient in the big picture of stopping the overall trend. Okay. And so what I would say is your listeners, I urge them to message their decision makers saying, hey, save grasslands, save prairie, whatever, wherever they are, wherever you are, whatever state, whatever you know, whatever your tie to grasslands is, you message your political representatives and say, grasslands are the most threatened ecosystem on the continent of the world, and I want you to fix it. And if they ask you how, to call Ted Cook. But again, our thesis, and I'm going to repeat our thesis, and this is where, Nick, I've been working with these ranchers for 3.5 years. They unscrewed the top of my head and poured their knowledge in, and still we're trying to refine our message, but this is our latest refinement. So all you listeners, listen up. Here's our proposal. We pay ranchers negotiated contracts for conservation outcomes. Now, hopefully that makes sense in and of itself. We pay for what we want, okay? How do you pay negotiated contracts for conservation outcomes? Step one, you show them the conservation outcomes, a list of habitat metrics that they need to meet. Step two, you agree on a price per acre and a time frame. So $50 an acre for 10 years, whatever. And then step three, at the end of the year, you monitor their performance. Did they meet those habitat metrics or not? And when they did, you pay them. Again, I hope that's simple enough for everyone to understand. But that's our proposal. None of the subsidy cost sharing, right? I mean, it's just unreasonable to go to a rancher in the southwestern Great Plains and say, hey, we want you to save this endangered species, the lesser prairie chicken, and we'll pay you 75% of what it costs. Really? Is that reasonable for us taxpayers to do to that private landowner? It's like, imagine this. You live in Duluth, right? You I don't know if you, let's assume you own your house and you live on a city street, okay? Is that true by chance?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So imagine the city of Duluth comes to you and all your neighbors, and they say, hey, Nick, you know, and neighbors, we want to expand the width of this road, and we're going to take 25% of your front yard, okay? We're going to take a quarter of your front yard. And here's the deal. We're only going to pay you 75% of that value, and we want you to just gift the other 25% because you're a good citizen.
Yeah.
Really?
That sounds like
there's
something
laws against
Duluth
that.
Might do.
What's that?
Yeah, that sounds like something Duluth might do.
Well, and governments have tried that, but that's why we have laws against that, right? I mean,
right.
Eminent domain and, you know, private property rights, right? They got to pay you for the value of the land that they take, right? And we don't want to take ranchers' lands, but we do want them to manage their lands in a way specifically to achieve outcomes that we as all Americans value for clean air, clean water, more water, healthy soils, healthy vegetation, healthy wildlife, carbon sequestration. If we Americans want it, we got to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. That's our proposal.
So is what you're talking about, is that CRP? I mean, how is CRP similar or not or dissimilar?
Great, great question. Okay. The largest remaining, first your listeners should know, the largest remaining population of lesser prairie chickens left on the face of the planet is on 35-year-old CRP in western Kansas. CRP today does not achieve that same level of conservation outcome. Why not? Three things. Back 35 years ago, there was no acreage cap on CRP or adjusted gross income cap for landowners participating. Step two, CRP paid at least twice as much per acre as it does today, if not more. And step three, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources Conservation Service had perhaps triple the number of staff to implement the program. Okay? So there were not these false caps. They paid what ranchers actually needed to be paid, and they had the staff to deliver. That's it. We don't have that today with CRP.
So it's paying less today, and we all know the cost of everything is higher. So you've got this, you know, double-edged sword where, it's even less incentive.
And the ranchers can't even go into their local NRCS office and find someone at their desk anymore. And if they do find someone at their desk, they don't know the programs well enough. And that's not a knock on NRCS. That's an example of the, unfortunately, I guess I'll
training knowledge education.
That's right. The increasing dysfunction, you know, of our government being able to provide services. And so this is one really tangible example. And so are we going to triple the number of USDA staff, and are we going to double to triple the payment rate per acre and get Congress to agree that, you know, acreage and adjusted gross income caps shouldn't be applied in these cases because we're trying to save the most threatened ecosystem on the continent and in the world? I don't know. But if Congress chose to go there, that would work. It worked once. It worked 35 years ago. That would work again.
Yeah, so we have an example of something that did work, which we, again, for this conversation, you can point to with lesser prairie chickens, but it's not there today.
That's right. Now, and we have other examples. So the Playa Lakes Joint Venture, everyone should get to know them. They're awesome. They're in the southwestern Great Plains. They've started this migratory bird Playa Lakes conservation program that they use a reverse auction. So here they take conservation reserve program, state acres for wildlife dollars, CRP safe is what it's called. And what they do is they go into it. They want to protect Playa Lakes for migratory birds and for water infiltration and for increased water quality, you know, in Playa Lakes. That's what recharges the aquifers, is when those waters sit in Playa Lakes and soaks into the underground aquifer, right? And by the way, it's also great places for migratory birds. I just talked to an LPCLA rancher friend this morning who counted 38 roosters on one of the Playa Lakes that he was looking at. So what the Playa Lakes Joint Venture does is they go into a county and they say, hey, all of you farmers, instead of trying to farm over your Playa Lake every year, what would it take for you to protect it? They ask the farmer what they need to get paid. Very simple, okay? And so the farmer has a couple of choices. One, they can ignore the question. Two, they can respond to the question and say what they need. And then, you know, then three, if they get the offer, close the deal. And so what the farmer will say is, well, I want to get paid X amount of dollars per acre to basically it's to leave a buffer around your playa lake. I want to get paid X amount of dollars per acre to leave this playa lake on this part of my property alone. Okay. And so then Playa Lakes Joint Venture gets bids from farmers across that county. And for the available dollars that they have, they go in and they say, you know what? This playa lake is the best playa lake in the right place with the best cost per acre conservation value. This is the best value. So we're going to do a contract with that farmer and then to that farmer and that farmer and that farmer. Okay. And it's for a period of years, whatever, 10 years, whatever it is. They pay to protect that playa lake. That works. It puts the agriculture producer in the driver's seat to say how much they need to get paid to deliver the ecosystem services that all of us Americans want. And that we appropriate billions of dollars a year to pay for, right? Farm Bill Conservation had billions of dollars a year. We want to pay for these things, but our effectiveness is reduced for all these different reasons.
Yeah.
And we're fixing to change that.
So I know we're getting close to time here, but I want to weave in, or I want to understand how the National Grasslands Conservation Act weaves in like status, that sort of thing, what that could accomplish. But then is it within the Farm Bill, are we looking to, does it take lobbying and voices to reappropriate the dollars inside of that to get some of these conservation outcomes?
Great question. So within the Farm Bill, we don't know. We've talked to people within the federal agencies who say, oh, Congress needs to act. And we've talked to congressional staffers who say, no, the agency has the authority to do these things. And so we're starting our full court press right now, frankly, Nick, to try to really get accountability and somebody to step up and say, let's do this. So we're hoping that the current Congress and Trump administration are going to be able to help with that. So good question. We have these examples, you know, so we've done it before. We can do it again.
Yeah.
Oh, you wanted to know about the
Grasslands Conservation Act. Yeah. I know that's sort of the thing that came up, you know, within the last couple of years. And I presume it's still being worked on, but what's the current status?
Yeah. National Wildlife Federation, Pheasants Forever, have been providing excellent leadership on a North American Grasslands Conservation Act, which is the analog to the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, which hopefully most of your listeners at least have some awareness of. It's been a really effective tool at conserving wetlands. And the same idea here, farmers keep trying to farm wetlands, but it's marginal and they don't make a lot of money. It's a struggle. And so the North American Wetlands Conservation Act comes in and says, hey, why don't you let us, you know, buy an easement, protect this, or, you know, buy it outright, whatever the model. Same thing with grasslands. What we're saying is the Grasslands Act would come in and offer these ranchers the opportunity to sell a conservation easement, like the conservation banking approach. And it would be administered by the Department of the Interior. And this is important because a lot of members of Congress don't want the Department of the Interior to implement this. But here's the thing. Farm Bill conservation title programs help ranchers while helping conservation. Department of Interior, National Wetlands Act and Grasslands Act help conservation while helping agriculturalists, right? So Farm Bill, agriculture first, conservation second. Department of Interior, conservation first, agriculture second. You put those together, and they're very powerful tools.
Hmm. Okay.
Now, I think that Grasslands Act has kind of been on the back burner, is my sense, but National Wildlife Federation, Pheasants Forever would be able to tell us more.
Go ahead and farm what you can efficiently farm, and the rest of it, we're going to help you take that out of agriculture and put it back into grasslands, essentially.
Yeah, that's the whole idea right there. It's like where it makes sense and makes money really legitimately and not just by subsidies to generate agricultural products. You know what? I like to eat food. Let's do that. But there's plenty of places where it doesn't make, and subsidies, you know, pervert markets and circumstances and landscapes. Let's start there. Let's just start there.
Has the North American Girls, were you guys always a membership organization, or?
We're privately funded so far. Actually, we did get a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which we're very grateful for. But we really need to up our game because we're on the precipice of trying to involve ranchers in the Northern Great Plains, who have seen our work with the Lesser Prairie Chicken Land Alliance, and they want to join forces, which is incredibly exciting. We currently lack the staff to support ranchers in the Northern Great Plains, but we need to be in fundraising to do that. And so We're a membership organization, Nick, and we offer a yearly magazine and, you know, email updates and that sort of thing. But really, we're a science-based policy advocacy organization that currently relies on private funding to try to influence policy in a deeply meaningful way.
All right. Yeah, I checked the website briefly before we got on, grousepartners.org. Folks can certainly learn more. I had not had a chance to see this, but it looks like you guys are involved in the video, Saving Ranching to Save Wildlife.
Yes, please.
That's Lesser Prairie Chicken Alliance.
Yes, our friends at Cornell Lab of Ornithology, who are big fans. Our whole idea, by the way, is to have landowners lead this. We're not the ones that are going to be talking to the Trump administration or members of Congress. It's the ranchers themselves. And they feel excited and empowered to do this thing, and including our new ranching friends in the Northern Great Plains. So our friends at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology are so excited about this landowner-led leadership that they offered to produce this 6-minute and 50-second long video featuring our landowners in this need for an entire paradigm shift on how it is we're going to stop and reverse the loss of grasslands.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can find that and membership and everything else. Because you guys got a calendar from Seth Sees. Somebody I've talked to him about coming on the podcast. We haven't had him on yet, but
he just sent us a donation check from sales of those calendars, which we're very grateful. He's awesome. Yeah. And there's also a link on the left side about the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance, and the video's there. And then there's also their Ranching Strongholds proposal document. You can actually read the 3.5-page document coupled with an appendix that's about 7 pages long that lists descriptions of things like 35-year-old CRP and Playa Lakes reverse auction program. So there's the link to that total 11-page document if you want to really get into the details.
Cool. All right, grousepartners.org for all that and more. And Ted, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on the podcast. We appreciate it. Thank you for increasing our knowledge and educating us on the stuff that you all are working on. Keep up the great work, my friend.
Nick, you too. Thanks so much. And I hope I wasn't over-enthusiastic.
No, this was a fun conversation. And like I said, we appreciate your time and your knowledge and everything that you and the team are working on. So keep it up.
Well, I love it. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thank you, Ted. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.